Hello guys, welcome to another Chalk Dude podcast. I put a request out on Facebook the other day asking for some subject to talk about because I realised I hadn't done a podcast in a while. And I had loads of feedback, loads of people asking questions and stuff like that. So we'll start getting through some of the questions. So first up, it was Nick Sanderson. He was saying that he'd just been watching the Chuck Liddell versus Tito Ortiz fight and asking, when's the right time to kind of call it quits? Well, the thing about combat sports is that it's high intensity and it's basically a young man's sport, and knowing the right time when to call it quits is a tough ask, because the thing is that we all love fighting, we all love the training, we all love the lifestyle and everything, and almost the showmanship and stuff like that can be very addictive, like getting waved at when you're walking down the street, getting asked for autographs and stuff like that. I mean, this is what I had when I was like living over in Thailand and stuff, and people would kind of recognize you from TV and be a bit of a superstar, and it was awesome. But the thing is that like when you're like integral sporting performance has taken a knock, and you're kind of tipping over that edge, maybe not in the best shape and stuff, then the question comes is whether it's a labour of love, or it's a sporting challenge, or whether you're looking to probably exploit the public one last time for a bit of a paycheck. Well, for me, this is what that last hurrah was from Chuck Liddell. I mean, what is he, like 48, 47, 48, something like that. I mean, he looked like an old man. He was really kind of struggling in there with his performance, and you could see from his from even like holding his shoulders back and maintaining his posture when he was in a, when he was going for the weigh-in and stuff. He looked like he was struggling, and it looked like he was in a lot of pain during it, even at the weigh-in, struggling to kind of keep his shoulders back, and the years of torture that he's been through, fighting on the UFC, fighting on Pride, fighting over in Japan, all the fights that he's had through his career, they've obviously taken its toll, and I mean, even at the back end of his career, when he was still competing on the UFC, he did start getting a bit chinny back then, and well, that chin never recovers. Some of the old boxing guys always talk about, like, you have a limit, you have a number of punches that you can take before you get chinny, and once that number's racked up, then that's your time to be hanging the gloves up. Well, this is what we saw during the fight. Tito kind of stalked him down. He almost kind of bullied him and pushed him back throughout the whole fight. And at that very first exchange, that's just how it was. So yeah, although they are legendary names, the fight was a bit of a letdown. And I wasn't particularly impressed by it. I mean, the gameness of the two guys, you could see the fire in the eyes, but the performance was just lacking. It was like having a gun pulling the trigger and no bang, no bullets in the chamber. So, but to actually call it quits, I mean, that's a tough call, because the thing is that there's lots of roles within combat sports, as I've done myself. I mean, I retired like 7 years ago. I never made any big statements or put it out on Facebook or anything. I just smoothly transitioned from competing to run in my gym. And I mean, there was no, like I said, no dramatic stasis or anything. It just was. And just making that transition from a fighter and being able to do the things automatically, you then start putting it into a process. And this is where, like, my engineering background has been fantastic, in the fact that I've been able to break these techniques down into, like, bite-sized chunks. So I'm taking loads of guys through, and all my guys are doing really well. So I'm pleased about that. And do I have to call it quits? Certainly not. It's you've got a if you've got a message to pass on, if you have an ability to be able to do some of these things, and at a kind of conscious level, and break it down into a process to pass on your experience, then that's what coaching is. And so you maybe do need to call it quits on the fighting side of things, but it's not turning your back on combat sports totally. If you can't get your buzz and get in the ring and actually compete. So yeah, that's my thoughts on it. Hope you take some solace from that. I mean, yeah, that's what I think Chuck should be doing now, is looking to pass his skills on to the next generation, and reap the benefits of what made him into the Iceman. So thanks for that one, Nick, and a great question. So moving on, we had a couple of questions about mental prep from Josh Robinson, one of our ultra white collar boxing guys, and Martin Jones, the photographer. We're talking about mental prep. Well, mental preparation before a fight is huge. I mean, such a vast array of techniques that can be used, and each and every person deals with these things in different ways, and there's always like a little kind of click of what the problem is. Now, there can be some generic statements made out there about learning how to deal with fear, and dealing with a crowd, and dealing with the uncertainty of a fight, but certainly something has to be seated in confidence. And confidence is probably one of the main underlying factors with regards to mental preparation, because it has to be a foundation. Dealing with fear, well, that can be reinforced and be broken down through hard work and commitment. The hard work and commitment that you put in the gym is basically to say, I'm going to put in my best performance for the amount of commitment that I've put in, and my conditioning, my fitness, and the skills and the strategy are testament to the hard work that I've, like I said, that I've put in the gym, and the preparation that I've allocated and made a priority in my life. Dealing with the crowd. For myself, whenever I was doing my Ram Muay dance, the ritual dance before a Thai boxing bout, I visualized kind of drawing a curtain around the edge of the ring. So the only three people that I was concerned about was my opponent, the referee, and myself. That's where my attention was. And even when I was fighting in front of 100,000 people on the King's birthday, it was just the same as when I was fighting in front of a crowd at the, like, working men's clubs when I was first starting out, and at Leeds Town Hall, and fighting in some of the arenas in Thailand and in Manchester and stuff like that. When you're fighting in front of a thousand, a couple of thousand people, it didn't particularly matter. And if your emphasis is on the crowd, then you're not thinking about yourself. You're not thinking about your own performance. And that's the number one thing where we need to keep that like mental tenacity switched on, and focused on the task in hand. The crowd is merely a distraction. They're there to watch. They don't have any. They don't have any input or effect. They're merely there as a distraction. And yeah, it's great to have the support, and it's great to hear them cheering you on when you're actually in there. But as a fighter, you're there to do a job. You're there to perform a task. And with all the best will in the world, yes, it's good to have the support, and you're always grateful for having your fans and the people that are buying tickets and the people that are supporting you. That's fantastic. However, as far as a performance factor is concerned, that can be additional pressure that you probably don't need. I mean, what one of the big things that I do with my guys is that I try and separate them away from the crowd and the vibe of the arena until they actually have to deal with it themselves, hyping themselves up and overthinking things and looking at the crowd and stuff. They need to be almost isolated away from that, so then they can stay focused on the task in hand. If you're thinking about the crowd, like I say, you're not thinking about what you're there to actually do. So yeah, that's a couple of the generic things that can affect you with regards to mental preparation. And a seat for your confidence is in the hard work that you've put in the gym as part of your preparation, like 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks preparation, building up towards like big fights and stuff like that. Well, only you know whether you've done the hard work that's required in order to win. And you get feedback on that, whether it's the win, whether it's the loss. And you can tell your coach whatever you think your coach wants to hear. But deep down, you as an individual, you know whether you've put in the hard work, you know whether you've grafted, whether you've left anything in the tank, or you've kind of pulling up short on your runs, or holding something back in your pad work and your sparring and things like that. So this is where the honesty of training comes into it. So yeah. As far as like other issues are concerned, mental preparation is a very like individualistic thing. When you start dealing with problems or baggage or misdirection or some of the issues that people deal with, this is why I do the mental performance work on an individual basis. And we can talk about some of the NLP things later on, but NLP and neuro-linguistic programming is one of the skills that we use. But everyone's an individual. Everyone deals with their problems in their own way. So that's why when we're doing the mental preparation work on an individual basis, we can really kind of smash these issues out of the park for the one-to-one work, because like I say, everybody's different. So again, another great question there from Josh Robinson and Martin Jones. Well, the next one was from Dimitri Paskovitz, one of the guys from over in Leeds. He trained with us for a little bit and then moved back over to Leeds. Very deep question regards to life and development and personal development and things like that. Now this is when you start almost strategizing for a for a fighter or strategizing for a client. In sporting terms, we talk it long-term athletic development. What are the milestones that you're trying to hit? What are the performance windows that you're trying to nurture? And there's different times in athletes' lives when they're going through stages of development, when they're going through childhood and through puberty and stuff like that, where you're going to start improving your coordination, you're going to start improving your explosive strength, your sprinting strength, your jumping strength, your cardiovascular system, your endurance. There's different windows and different pockets within the within athletic sporting performance that we can tailor specific training programs for. But with regards to personal development, I mean, this is when we start crossing that line between a coach, between a lifestyle coach, being a personal mentor, and probably into some like parenting skills as well. Well, like I say, I've got two boys myself, and I put myself under a lot of pressure when my first lad was born, when Oscar was born. I put myself under a lot of pressure, and because I'd only just finished my NLP training, and within the NLP training, they said that the first 7 years of life are kind of like the imprint period. It's when we develop and learn our skill set. We learn to adapt, and we get a snapshot of lifestyle. Now, there's loads of things that we can start talking about from a parental perspective and a coaching perspective and things like that. But I think all in all, it starts coming back to values. One of the main things that Dimitri started asking about was making good choices. Well, as a parent, you can't make all the choices for your kid that your kid has to make. So what you have to do is like probably instill the values of working hard, of clean living, of the benefit of hard work paying off, and the benefit of smart work paying off, being able to manage things how you want to manage things, and what kind of an example do you want to be? Now, yeah, okay, like sometimes I may not be here for taking the kids on the school run, getting them to school on the morning, or I might not be here at bedtime. But what I hope that's displaying is I'm showing my boys the benefit of hard work and the levels of commitment that are required in order to lead a good example and show a good example that hard work pays off. And yeah, this is what the levels of commitment that it takes. Now, yeah, I'm probably setting myself some high standards, and again, I dare say that comes from my own parenting, from my own parents. My dad was a grafter, and my mum was nurtured us at home and looked after us and that kind of thing. My dad kind of gave us the guidance and a bit of direction with regards to kind of homework and academic planning and academic revision. But all in all, this is what's then meant that I've gone on to achieve what I've been able to achieve, being able to balance having a strong sporting background, a strong academic background, and staying away from drink and drugs, and get myself in bother and with the law and stuff like that. So, like I say, it's a balancing act, but also leading by example and hoping that they kind of pick up on that. Again, a very probably a bit of an airy fairy answer there, but because I haven't like pinpointed or bullet pointed any specific actions on that. But what I am saying is that you can see the levels of commitment that I'm putting in, not only with the business, but the amount of dedication that I give to my fighters, and the amount of time that I'm spending like down at the gym. And I did a day in the life of video with a company called Snapature. They're a videographer based in York. Yeah, he followed us around for a day just to give a snapshot of what a day in the life of my work involves. Unfortunately, we weren't able to film any of the work down at Queen Ethelberg's College, where I do a lot of the after school clubs and take care of all the combat sports down there. But what it did show it is the early morning starts and the late finishes, and the variety of people that you get to speak to, the flexibility in communication, and some of the different kind of plates that are spinning that some people don't see in the background. The thing is that if people just turn up to one or two classes a week, all they see is the gym running on, they see the classes running on at night time. A lot of people don't realise how busy I am through the day with the additional coaching and stuff that I do. So, like I say, hope that leads with a good example, and giving people the levels of commitment that are required on a daily basis, and the lifestyle that I've been living for the past 10 years this year. 10 years that I've been self-employed this year. So yeah, I mean, it's not an overnight thing, and you just got to get your nose to the grindstone and put the graft in and let the chips fall where they may with regards to parenting. So yeah, hope that answers your question, Dimitri, and if not, then just give us a buzz and drill in any more that you'd like to. But yeah, thanks for the question. Next up was Josh Nicholson asking about mentality of a beginner. The thing is that when you're Josh is one of our one of the guys is carried through from the ultra white collar boxing. He's come through. He's had a bit of an injury and a bit of a knockback at the start of this year. He had an injury through work. So yeah, I understand where you're coming from with regards to mentality of a beginner, because this is one of the things why I started doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I started Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu as I was at the end of my kind of Thai boxing career. Not only did I enjoy the use of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in MMA, but I wanted to keep that like newbie humbleness. It stops you getting too big for your boots. I mean you can kind of rest on your laurels and call yourself a world champion and stuff like that, but at the end of the day, there has to be a level of connection and to know what it's like as a beginner. Remember what it was like 22 years ago, 24 years ago now, when I started doing Thai boxing. It's a long time to remember what it was like as a beginner. However, I'm now a beginner in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and understanding what that process is like, again, is part of the process. There's because of our like almost academic and pinpointing key areas. Because of our style of coaching, there's a lot of key details and levels of comfort and levels of contact that you need to be happy with in order to get to that like next level. There's a certain amount of toughness. There's a certain amount of coordination required. And sometimes the information can be academic because it's good information to know. But I can also understand that it can be a bit overwhelming when you're being. This is one of the reasons why at seminars there's like the golden half hour, the golden 40 minutes right at the start of a seminar where you're going to get the key foundations and the real basics, the building blocks of what you require in order to get to that next level. This is why I like to focus on the basics. So like the last seminar that we had down at the gym, it was with Darren and Helen Curry, our BJJ black belts from Pontefract. We had a seminar on 50-50 guard. There's a couple of key foundation things that we started out with at the start of that move in order how to enter into that particular guard, that way of controlling your opponent. This involved inverting. And for those of you that aren't involved with the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, this means when you're inverting, it means that you're kind of doing like a backward roll and you're kind of going upside down. But then you also have to be dexterous with your legs and use your legs to essentially sweep your partner and knock your partner over and get onto the back. The foundation skill of being able to invert and then the most basic moves are probably where the value of the seminar is for the majority of people. As you get longer and longer into the seminar, the combinations get more and more complex. They get longer, further and further away from the fundamentals, and so therefore it leads on to being one of the skills for the more experienced guys as they're more comfortable with doing the fundamentals. This is one of the things, like I said, dealing with this overwhelm of information. If you can take one thing from the lesson, if you can take one thing away from that seminar, that's your gem. That's your bit of gold dust. And all it is having patience. Now, I know that may seem like a bit of a cop out, but the thing is that these things don't happen overnight. These things don't just magically appear. It takes a lot of hard work. It takes a lot of dedication. It takes years and years of practice to refine the skills that are required in order to distill down the information so that you can get that gem, that bit of gold dust that boosts your performance on to the next level. Only this week we've been talking about this concept in the Thai boxing classes. We've been talking about how people move around and understanding about range and distance and like visualizing your range as a series of Russian dolls all kind of stacked inside each other. Obviously the biggest doll on the outside is like your push kicking range. Inside that you have your body kicking range. Inside that you have your boxing. Inside that you have your clinching elbows. Now, what we found, like through explanation, is that the thing that was blowing people's minds that we've talked about there is four distinct ranges. However, the distance between those ranges can literally be about 2 or 3 centimeters. Now, just put that in context. The space, covering the space of 10 centimeters is the difference between landing a push kick and landing an elbow. 10 centimeters difference in footwork position. Okay. Now, as you grasp that idea, you might be kind of questioning it. You might be thinking about, well, if an arm's like, say, a meter, and your legs maybe 1 meter 20, there's obviously a 20 centimeter difference between your push kicking range and your boxing range. Well, not when you're in a staggered stance, not when how your partner's moving in. It's all about these relative positions. That's one of the gems from this week, and one of the things that's been blowing a lot of people's minds when we've been able to explain that during our classes. So that's probably one of the biggest from this week. Dealing with injuries, well, there's always going to be bumps and bruises. We're doing combat sports, but knowing the right time to give the correct amount of attention, and not like over-indexing on injuries and looking for sympathy and stuff like that. It's understanding, do you need to seek medical attention? Can you look after it yourself? What are the self-help things that you're doing? You're trying to reduce inflammation with ice packs and heat shock therapy and things like that. Are you getting enough sleep? Is your diet and nutrition on point? Are you filling yourself full of toxins? Because when I say toxins, I'm saying, are you eating a load of crap food? Are you filling yourself up with McDonald's and pizzas and takeaways just because you're feeling a bit grumpy, a bit down, and a bit flat because you've got a bit of a cold, or you've got an injury? Well, is that takeaway? Is that McDonald's? Is that beer going to help you recover? Or is it a toxin that in your system that your body doesn't need, that's going to take away healing energy away from your injury? Now, this is, and again, this comes back to leading by example. It comes back to the discipline that's required, for you have a certain amount of healing energy in your body. If that's distracted with having to deal with flushing a lot of toxic shit out of your system, like with takeaways and beers and alcohol and that kind of thing, then yeah, it's going to take longer to recover. You're going to increase the inflammation in your system, and you're not going to allow your body to recover as efficiently as it possibly could. So I suppose that's the biggest bang for your buck that you're going to get for dealing with injuries, is make sure that you're fueling yourself right, and that your body can recover as quickly as possible, dealing with the least amount of toxins and the least amount of damage and the least amount of inflammation in other areas of your body. And so then you can get back on the mats as quickly as possible. We have, we've had people down at the gym that have had hand injuries and things like that. Well, okay, what that means is that they haven't been able to box for a couple of months, but it hasn't stopped them from working their boxing with their alternative hand, using their elbows, using the kicks, using the knees. So as opposed to the art of eight limbs of Thai boxing, when they've had an injured hand, they've had the art of seven limbs. This is the kind of positive attitude that we bring, and a direction to getting in the mat time and also building up those kinetic chains so that we can keep repeating the movements, but maybe not with the level of impact that we're used to, so that we're not putting our bodies under trauma, therefore recovering other areas and taking attention away from the injury sites. I hope that kind of comes across. Any more questions? Then just DM us or give us a bit of feedback when I post this up on Facebook. And last but by no means least, a question about from our heavyweight guy Kay Shoma, asking about titles. Well, I've talked about this before, and there's only a couple of titles that bring real credibility, that kind of bring the real value to what we're talking about. The benefit is that, yeah, okay, if you're using titles to make fights, then titles can be created from nothing. I mean, the value is in the people that are fighting for them. So, for instance, when I first started out and I was looking for, I wanted the titles and I wanted all the acclaim and stuff like that. My coach, Richard Smith, he turned around to us and says, well, okay, who's your favourite fighter? And immediately my answer was there straight away. It was rolling off my tongue. I said, Ivan Hippolyte. And that's who I kind of really looked up to it when I first started out. He turned around to me and says, well, what titles has he got? I was stumped because I couldn't name the titles that he had. And I was his fanboy back then. I was watching all of his fights. I was searching him out on YouTube and stuff like that. But I didn't know what titles he had. The only thing that I knew is that I loved his style. And looking back now, you don't remember the titles that people have got. You remember the performances that people put in. The title doesn't make the fighter. The fighter makes the title. Okay, so if you're basing it on that, then okay, it's up to you to be the benchmark of that title. You're gonna make that title credible by making people fight harder for it. So if you want to bring value to your titles, then train your ass off, have that blue sky thinking, and make people fight for those titles that you're holding, so then that brings more credibility to your titles, and then sooner or later, so believe it or not, you forget about the titles. It becomes one of them things where, yeah, okay, I'm proud to say I'm a 2-time world champion. A lot of people won't know the actual name of the association that my title was under. Some will, some won't, but the fact of the matter is that I fought hard, I fought on some great shows, I fought some big names, and when you're fighting for these the other names that have fought for those titles, you're in like a Hall of Fame category. And again, that's what brings the credibility to the title. If I look back at other people that have won the same world title as me, like previous holders, you have people like Satmon Cole, you have Liam Harrison, you have Nita, you have Toby Smith. There's loads of really big names from all over the world, but you remember the fighters. You may not necessarily remember the actual title and the actual weight category, and you start drilling down into the detail, and it's a nice to have. The fact of the matter is that titles are good, titles are nice, and they're like the dressing on the cake. However, like today, I was watching a podcast, and one of the fighters that was on the podcast said that it was their 14th fight and their 6th world title. 14 fights and 6 world titles. Well, okay, they must be good to be rolling at that depth and that level after only 14 fights, but what credibility is on those titles? This is when it's drawn into question. So yeah, like I say, the titles then become almost irrelevant as soon as you start focusing on your individual performance, and you can then later on in your career, when you retire, you can look back and say, I held so-and-so title, and I fought X, Y, and Z for these titles, and they meant something. And I suppose that's all you can do. But yeah, don't dwell too much on it, because it's a nice to have. It's not an essential. So yeah, thanks for that one, Kay, and hope you enjoyed the answer. And yeah, that brings us to the end. So I think we've been going about 40 minutes now. So yeah, it's a decent length podcast. Answered a few questions. Hope you enjoyed it. And in summary, a quick little recap: if people want to get in touch about the mental preparation and the individual coaching, then just drop us a message, send us a private message on Facebook. You can find us on Coach Cadden, the Coach Cadden page. You can message us on there, book in for a private session. And yeah, if you want any personal training, then that's where to find us. Okay, hope to hear from you soon, guys. I'll speak to you soon. Thanks a lot. Cheers. Goodbye.